Hi there, everyone.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Sally Elcordi, and welcome to Public Advocate. I am running for Public Advocate of New York City to ban vaccines in 2013 because the ingredients are poisonous, the diseases are all diseases in internal medicine, and the intent has been clearly established. So the hoax is over. Nothing's keeping us from banning vaccines except complete and utter inaction. And this is a call to action. I'm going to talk a little bit later about that, but right now I'm going to pick up an actual advocate, an attorney on vaccine rights, a highly respected gentleman, Alan Phillips. Please wait while I pick him up. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Sally. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm exhausted. I just had 4 interviews. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well, thank you.
Okay. Well, this is October Vaccine Injury Awareness Month almost, not quite yet. Do you have anything planned to bring attention to vaccine injury?
Well, just more of what I'm already doing. I do probably about a dozen regular radio shows a month and love to come and talk with you at any time. A real pleasure and honor, as always, to be with you here today and write articles as my time allows and then keep on plugging away. To the best of my knowledge, I'm the only attorney in the country whose practice is focused on vaccine exemptions and waivers. I work with clients around the country and in over a dozen different categories and subcategories where immunizations are required and people are looking to understand and exercise their right to refuse vaccines.
Right, exactly. Do you find that anybody realizes that they're 100% poison?
I'm finding that it's sort of a very curious time, Sally, because I see, on the one hand, the vaccine agenda train rolling down the tracks at full speed, in fact, increasing speed, accelerating recently. I'm sure we'll talk about some of the ways that that's going on, and seemingly without anyone applying the brakes, and yet at the same time, I believe and feel and see that more and more people are waking up to the problems and asking questions and saying what the heck's going on. Now, I think a lot more people have concerns than there are people that are actively acting on those concerns. But, you know, we take things one step at a time. But awareness is growing, and I'm hearing reports from different corners, so to speak, that strongly suggest that more and more people are concerned and are understanding more and more about what's really going on with vaccines. So that's heartening.
Well, do you think that our country will get to this point, and I just saw this post today, so it may be news to you. In Nigeria, 120 people have been jailed for refusing the polio vaccine. And people who are like pastors, people who have a congregation, have been warned that they too will be jailed if they professed anything against the vaccine. These vaccines, according to the article, are mandated by the government, the polio vaccine. So I wanted to get your read on do you think we're headed in that direction if the government had its way?
These kind of things, I can't say I'm surprised, but I'm deeply disturbed by it at the same time. I have watched a very disturbing pattern here in the U.S. of a very aggressive pursuit of just what I collectively call the vaccine agenda. I see this playing out on multiple levels, and it concerns me on multiple levels as well, not just with respect to each level or area where I see this aggressive agenda playing out, but the manner in which it's playing out. There are, for example, just as an example, 3 states in the last 3 years, Washington State, California, and Oregon, in 2011, 2012, and 2013 respectively, have each passed laws making it harder for parents to exercise vaccine exemptions that are required for kids for school enrollment. And in each case, they've passed laws that, in my opinion, are clearly unconstitutional, at least with regard to those people who have qualifying religious objections, and it's just a side note, what qualifies for a religious exemption is really, really broad. A religious exemption doesn't matter whether you belong to a church at all. It doesn't matter which one you belong to if you do belong to one. So a lot of people mistakenly think, oh, I'm not a Christian Scientist, I can't get a vaccine religious exemption. And actually, it's not at all restricted under federal law, under the First Amendment of the Constitution, not at all restricted to membership in an organized religion or to any particular interpretation of whatever your religion is if you are a member of an organized religion. So it's tricky with respect to those situations where you have to state the beliefs that are opposed to vaccines, because there are several what I call legal pitfalls. Depending on the situation or what state, sometimes you have to state your beliefs and sometimes you don't. So when people are in situations where they do have to state their beliefs, I recommend getting some additional information. Probably, if it's really important to you, do a consultation with an attorney experienced in this area so that you can have a legally sound statement of beliefs, because in my experience, what most people come up with when they do that on their own, they wander into one or more of what I call legal pitfalls that can cause it to backfire on them. But as a starting place, it's really, really broad. You know, anyone who's not an atheist, it's literally that broad that anyone who's not an atheist can potentially qualify for a vaccine religious exemption. So anyway, I'm seeing state legislatures pass laws that violate the Constitution. And this is really disturbing, because what really goes on, Sally, in this arena, a law is not officially unconstitutional unless a court says so. You and I can have our opinion about that, but it's not officially unconstitutional unless a court says so. And what this means is that states can pass any law they get the votes for. Legislatures can pass anything they get the votes for. Now, they all state legislators around the country take an oath to uphold the state and federal constitutions. But that oath goes out the window if they decide it goes out the window, and they can vote for political reasons or whatever reasons they want to. Any law can be passed because it's not officially unconstitutional. Even if it's obviously unconstitutional, it's not officially unconstitutional until a court says so. And so what the vaccine industry is doing, I'm sure among others, to take advantage of this is applying whatever political pressure or persuasion they can to get laws passed that violate the Constitution, but they can get them passed anyway. And those bills get passed into laws, and those laws go take effect, and people are then unconstitutionally restricted from exercising valid legal exemptions.
There are two situations I'd like to run by you, and I'm sure you're familiar with both of them. One of them is in West Virginia. The legislature voted down mandated vaccines, but the health commissioner, who's appointed by the governor, has imposed them, along with criminalization of parents who are not complying. So that is stupefying. And another issue was here in New York. Parents sued because her child was given an H1N1 flu shot in school, and she won, and then an appeal by, I believe it was the health department or health commission, the federal government overrode the state government because the pandemic laws are still in effect. They haven't been lifted since 2009, meaning the federal government trumps the state government, which I presume is precedent setting. But you could let me know what you think.
I read about that case a little while back, and it made sense to me on the legal analysis level, but I found the result disturbing on sort of common sense terms. The federal government, as a starting place, does not have authority to reach into the state level, well, on a lot of different issues, but in with healthcare, like for example, the federal government can't mandate vaccines for state residents. But if I understood this particular case correctly, and if I recall correctly, it was the federal government's implementation of a state of emergency, a swine flu emergency, which created a condition in which, because federal law is a higher legal authority than state law, or if you could think of it as federal law supersedes state law. So when there's a, there are exceptions everywhere in law, but in general, if there's a conflict between state and federal law, the federal law wins, or trumps, if you will, supersedes the state law. And so if I remember correctly in this case, Sally, what was happening was that, in effect, the parents won the case at the state law level, and then they lost on appeal because of a superseding federal legal right or issue that had to do with having declared a swine flu emergency. This is...
aren't they required to lift that when the emergency is over? I mean, isn't that called into question?
Well, there's sort of two separate issues here, as there is probably to one degree or another with any legal issue. There's what are the legal boundaries and lines and so forth, what are the rights and responsibilities, requirements, procedures, and all of that, all the technical and strictly legal questions. And then there is, well, what goes on in the real world? You know, on a common sense level, of course, once the emergency is over, you withhold the emergency. But what we saw with the swine flu pandemic in 2009, there were 11 different states that declared swine flu emergencies. Obama declared a national swine flu emergency, and it turned out there was no pandemic. There was a swine flu virus, but it was milder than the seasonal flu virus. What happened there, Sally, was that the World Health Organization redefined level 6, their highest level for a pandemic, over the objection of several countries, so that they could call this mild disease, at the time, the swine flu, a top level 6 pandemic. When they did that, it triggered contract clauses between the pharmaceutical industry and countries all over the world for the sale of what ended up being about $18 billion U.S. Funds equivalent, $18 billion of vaccines, most of which were never even administered. You know, France and England, for example, purchased enough swine flu vaccines to vaccinate most of the population in both of those countries. They ended up administering somewhere between 5% and 10%, you know, of those populations actually got vaccines. We had a reported 30% of the U.S. population vaccinated for swine flu. We had $260 million worth of vaccines that got thrown out because they expired because nobody wanted them. So even with all the propaganda here, and if you watch TV at that time, you would see, you know, people lining up for an hour or hours to get their swine flu vaccine, and all of those kind of probably isolated instances were highly promoted as, here's what's going on everywhere, better hurry up and get your vaccine before you die. And
before we move back to the West Virginia thing, I have a hard time retaining questions, believe it or not, but I'm being sprayed with chemtrails, which are making me early onset Alzheimer's. This is not a joke. But before we get back to West Virginia, I need to ask this one question, and let's see if I can remember it. The pandemic laws and the CDC schedule, can we nullify them at the state level?
Well, okay, so let me go back a step and reel me back in if I get away again or if I don't answer your question. So the federal government doesn't have authority to reach into at the state level and mandate vaccines. It's up to individual states to decide what vaccines are required. It's up to individual states or sometimes individual counties within states to decide whether or not to declare a swine flu emergency. There were some, or an emergency of any kind. There were some instances during the swine flu pandemic where individual counties declared swine flu emergencies. I found that to be kind of interesting. There were all these states in the U.S. that declared, and Obama for the whole U.S., that declared emergencies when there wasn't an emergency. But when you declare an emergency, Sally, the legal landscape changes whether there's really an emergency or not. And this
right,
is what
I know. For example, in Canada, Kevin Annette was telling me that there was a swine flu scare in the most remote Indian villages. who are completely nowhere near any kind of swine flu, but they're the ones who had to get inoculated. Isn't that interesting? And it's also part of their contract with the government that they cannot refuse vaccines, not unlike what's going down in Nigeria. So you always have to look at the people who are being targeted to know what the real agenda is. But I really seriously want to know if it's possible to nullify the CDC schedule, which everybody is, this is what they're adhering to. So you're saying,
well,
possibly state by state we could nullify?
Yeah, the CDC makes recommendations, but they don't mandate vaccines for state residents. So it's still up to each individual state legislature to decide what vaccines to require. And there are some differences state to state, even though on the whole, it seems to me that states will generally rubber stamp the CDC recommendations and enact their recommendations into law. But the actual laws are at the state level for the most part. Now, the federal government can mandate vaccines for the military, for our immigrants, U.S. territories, you know, any federal jurisdiction. But most of the time what we're dealing with is state law in terms of legal requirements.
Okay,
and
then can we nullify the pandemic laws?
Well, every state has its own pandemic laws. Now, there are going to be pandemic laws of the federal government. For example, when you're talking about interstate travel, that's a federal jurisdiction. So the federal government can pass laws that would deal with interstate travel in a declared emergency, for example, or U.S. airspace is a federal jurisdiction. So it's sort of interesting. There are these different layers or levels of authority, and to some extent they may overlap.
Well, just explain to me why I can't get action on the state level, Congress will not take action either, in terms of chemtrails, which is the airspace. Unfortunately, it's affecting everything below it.
Well, the one word answer to the question is politics, and I'm not sure there's a short answer, you know, to any of these questions. You know, it's like I am often telling my clients that, for example, in the healthcare arena, where hospitals all over the country are requiring healthcare workers to get flu shots or lose their jobs. And I tell them, the short-term solution is find out what your rights are, how to exercise them, take the reasonable steps available, deal with the issue you're dealing with in front of you right now, your employer's requiring you to get a flu shot. But the long-term solution in this arena and many other arenas is legislative. And then I find myself saying, using this analogy, and I say, I realize I've just given you a glass of water and told you to put out a forest fire with it. Because going up against the pharmaceutical lobby to try and get, you know, legislators' attention and focus on an issue that the pharmaceutical industry is going to be opposing is a very tall order. But there are some successes out there. Oregon actually has a law that prohibits hospitals from mandating flu vaccines. As far as I know, it's the only state in the country that has such a law. I believe Wisconsin and Michigan have bills or will have bills addressing the same issue. We should be doing that in all 50 states. But where the rubber meets the road on this issue, in large part, from my perspective anyway, is in the state legislatures. There are over 100 vaccine bills pending in over 30 states right now, or the last time I checked. And most of those bills, if they're passed into law, will be furthering this very aggressive, overly aggressive vaccine agenda, requiring more vaccines of children than they already get, requiring vaccines for new categories of people, different adult populations, such as healthcare workers, childcare workers, and teachers, allowing pharmacists to administer vaccines, allowing children to consent to vaccines, which is blatantly unconstitutional. But, just most of these are furthering the pro-vaccine agenda if they pass and become law. So it's a very active arena legislatively at the state level, and we've got to become active and oppose these aggressive pro-vaccine agenda bills and start introducing and supporting the pro-informed choice.
Okay, well, let us now get back to West Virginia, because this is something that if their legislature voted it down and the health commissioner has mandated it successfully and criminalized parents who don't like it, I said to them, march on the governor's mansion. Say, hold up the list of ingredients and say that you're poisoning our children. We hold you culpable for their death.
Well, I tell you, there.
What window is left to them? What window is left to them if this is enforced? And I was talking to the woman who runs NVIC for West Virginia. She said she saw a woman, a child, forced inoculated with 14 vaccines at once.
And tell me again exactly what it is that was voted down, because I don't think I'm familiar with the specifics.
Well, their legislature did not vote for mandates, okay? No mandates per their legislature. So they thought they could breathe easy. And the health commissioner, who was appointed by the governor, declared that not only were they mandated for children to go to school, but they the parents who objected would be criminalized. This is a very serious issue, Alan. The people in West Virginia have, I mean, Mississippi is bad enough with the mandate, and of course you can still homeschool, but not everybody can homeschool. And they are targeting, I feel, among the poorest populations in this country, in Mississippi and in West Virginia. These are not known as affluent states.
Well, of course, you know, the goal here is to vaccinate everyone as many times as you can. And even if you look no farther than the, you know, follow the money trail, obviously the more people, children and adults who get vaccines, and the more vaccines they get, the more profit for the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, look at the backdrop here, Sally. The federal government spends billions of dollars every year subsidizing vaccine research and development. They, both the state and federal governments mandate vaccines. Both state and federal governments purchase vaccines. And both state, in some instances, but I think primarily the federal government, will compensate if you're lucky enough to get compensation, because only about a quarter of the people who are injured or families of people who are killed by vaccines who apply for compensation from the federal government actually get compensation. But the government pays them to make the product, it buys the product from them, it mandates the product for the general public, and turns around and pays for the damage and holds the pharmaceutical companies immune from liability, dark sick pun intended there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, you take morality and ethics out of the picture if you're looking at just the numbers. I mean, who wouldn't want a piece of that pie from a purely business, you know, profit point of view?
The AMA is the society, or they're a trade union. What is the AMA? A society or a trade union?
Well, I don't know specifically what they are. I know there is.
I was reading an article by Christina England in Backtruth that said that unless you opt out to the AMA, you are a test subject. This is quite an amazing announcement from what might be a society or a trade union. Will it only pertain to the members of the society and trade union, or no? They want this to pertain to the general public. And this, I would like you to think about that, and I'll send you the article. I'm not going to ask you to, if you're not sure what category they are in, you know, you'd have to know that. But
Well, I have seen articles about people recommending, as a matter of medical ethics, recommending that children be required to participate in vaccine trials, because they're having trouble getting people volunteering for vaccine trials, and so they want to.
this is adults too, and I always like to tell adults that so they don't think you're immune, nor are they immune from the HPV, simply because that is staying, that basically gives anybody who's had the HPV vaccine and donates blood, now it's in the blood banks and it's causing cancer. So it's affecting everybody, and I hate speaking about solely about children, because for some reason adults who don't have children, or adults even who do have children, don't get the full impact of this. And the AMA's opt-out thing does not just pertain to children. However, anthrax in children, approved by the Bioethics Commission and the Health and Human Services, the Presidential Commission on Bioethics, this is a done deal. This is thumbs up. And I'm thanking God for it, because people don't believe that they don't know what's in their vaccine until these people go and approve testing anthrax on children. And I watched that whole hearing, or that round table discussion, and basically they said it's going to be applied to ever increasing ages of people. So again, adults, this is not just about children, as appalling as it would be to be just about children, it's not.
Well, everybody has a target on their back. You know, I mentioned, for example, that the hospitals around the country, in a couple of instances, it's state laws, but mostly as a company policy level, mandating flu vaccines for healthcare workers. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services has a this Healthy People 2020 initiative, or whatever it is, where they have a stated goal of vaccinating 90% of healthcare workers, and they've actually managed to tie this into Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements. So it's a financial obligation on the part of the hospitals now if they want to get their full Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements. But they have a separate goal to vaccinate all U.S. employees with the flu vaccine. And, of course, flu vaccines are recommended for any child or infant 6 months or older. And you just, there's a point in which you just have to ask, what is it that's in these vaccines that they want in all of our bodies? Because it's clearly not about anything scientific. There are multiple mainstream sources, not anti-vaccine people, not conspiracy theorists, people right out of mainstream medicine, peer-reviewed published journals, running reviews and articles, saying over and over again, there isn't any credible medical literature supporting these mandatory healthcare worker flu policies. The vaccines don't work. They don't have any effect on working days lost. In fact, I hear over and over again from people all over the country that it's the people, I hear from the healthcare workers themselves, that it's the ones who get the vaccine that end up getting sick and taking days off. And I hear that with almost every single healthcare worker that I talk to. It's amazing.
Well, and that's why the hoax is over. All of these documents have been unearthed. And this is why I'm saying, like, I used to say to my mother, like, he has no manners. And she'd say, yes, he does. He has bad manners. Well, they're using the word healthy. Well, I guess they might mean bad healthy. There's good healthy and bad healthy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but
this is
all
just
this
is all just to open the door
to misinform people. If we were to say life-stealing vaccines instead of life-saving vaccines, people would understand, say no, but they're not. So the fact that we are being lied to, are they not even culpable for lying to us?
There's a difference many times between the legal reality and the factual reality. For example, before any vaccine to be used in the U.S., it has to first be licensed by the FDA. Now, there's a couple of steps to this, so stay with me on this, Sally.
Yes.
When a vaccine is licensed by the FDA, it carries with it a legal presumption that the vaccine is safe and effective, or else it wouldn't have been licensed. I mean, that's one of the points of the licensing procedure, is to make sure that we have safe and effective products that are being used on the public. I don't personally believe for a second that vaccines are safe and effective. You don't have to name them. I'll say that I've been researching this issue for almost 20 years now, since my 19-year-old was born, and I find that the deeper I dig, the messier it gets. But legally, vaccines are presumed to be safe and effective when they're licensed. There's a similar rationale that applies with vaccine laws. You know, every state has laws mandating vaccines for school enrollment. When a legislature passes a law mandating vaccines, the legislature is presumed to have considered, are these vaccines safe? Are these vaccines effective? Are they necessary? And all of those sort of obvious health-related questions. And the law, when it's passed, carries a legal presumption. You can think of it as a legislative presumption or a legal presumption that the vaccines are, in fact, safe and effective, or else the state legislature, in its infinite wisdom, would not have passed such a law.
Okay, now, back to nullification. Can we nullify the FDA? Can we nullify the pandemic laws, the CDC schedule, and the FDA?
Well, we can become legislatively active and change the laws. Now, when I say these vaccines are presumed to be safe and effective, I'm talking about a presumption. A presumption is only a starting place. So, you know, that presumption can be challenged. And the bottom line here, in my opinion, as a practical matter, for the most part, the place to challenge those presumptions is with the state legislatures as a practical matter. I mean, theoretically, or in some situations, you can challenge those presumptions in court. But in general, for the most part, I think it's better to fight these, because the cases I've seen where people go after sort of the broad general concerns about vaccines, when they do that in court, they tend to lose. So I think as a practical matter, the place to deal with these horrible presumptions is to change the laws. So we change the laws, we change those legal presumptions. But in any event...
Justice, though, I have to say, when I started this, when I started to wake up, it was basically with the healthcare workers here in New York State, and Judge Diamond had called for the science, and I thought, wowee, I didn't even know that they were as toxic as they were at the time, but I thought, oh, this is getting interesting. That never happened. That hearing, that I had called everybody back to the courthouse for that, but it never happened. So the question is, if a judge has called for the science, which is, aren't you impressed by that? Yet it never happened.
Well, I am impressed because it's a very general proposition. Courts don't decide science. Courts weigh the evidence. And so they will look at what the experts say. And so if the CDC comes in and says the vaccines are safe.
Without the science. She felt she couldn't make a judgment without the science. I felt I was ecstatic about that. I thought this is as close as we're ever going to come to getting, but it never happened.
Right. Well, the judge isn't going to himself or herself decide the science. What they're going to do is look at the weight of the evidence. What do the experts say? And what the experts say is what carries the weight of the evidence. And this is another example of why I think the issue is often more effectively addressed at the legislative level, because if the experts are corrupt, and I can give you all kinds of documented instances of corruption in the CDC, for example, but if the experts are corrupt, then their expert opinion is going to be corrupt, but that's what's going to carry the weight legally. And that's why we need to get into the legislature to educate legislators. But, you know, legislators don't always... The single biggest barrier on this whole issue, in my opinion, Sally, is not a scientific one, it's not a legal one, it's a psychological one. We have, I'd love to give you, if you'll allow me here, take a couple minutes and give you an example on by analogy with another issue that I'm sure is one you're passionate about. There, you can go onto YouTube and search 9/11 psychologist, and you'll find a series of videos of psychologists around the country who are talking about a phenomenon with the 9/11 issue, and I want to use that as an analogy with the vaccine issue, if I may.
Essentially, I agree with you. I posted it on every vaccine page, that particular analogy you're about to talk about.
Oh, okay, great. So old news to you then. Well, hopefully it'll be something new and helpful for your listeners then.
I'm just saying, it hit me. I was like, wow, this is a vaccine truth person's ultimate video.
Yeah. So what, in essence, what these psychologists are asking is, or the issue they're addressing is, well, we've got this situation with 9/11 where the official view is clearly inconsistent with the laws of physics. And why is it, when that's so obvious, and when you look at it objectively, why is it that so many people can't see that or refuse to see it or what have you? And what they come up with is, and this was fascinating when I ran across this, because I had already stumbled on this in my own thinking, kind of a vague way or general way, but they really added clarity to this for me. I was just really appreciative of seeing this and sort of validating my own prior thinking to a large degree. But at any rate, that there's a subconscious psychological defense mechanism, and it boils down to something like this, that the implications are so dark, so far-reaching, so profound, the suggestion that the 9/11 might have had something to do with some sort of governmental or shadow government or inside faction or whatever. But the point is that, you know, in one form, way, or another, yes, it was a pre-planned event that had nothing to do with planes crashing and terrorists and so forth. It was an inside job, whatever you want to call it. The implications of that are so deep and dark that psychologically people can't handle it, and so they create a subconscious defense mechanism. Let's look at vaccines for a second. If the anti-vaccine people are right, Sally, then that means that most doctors don't know what they're doing, that at least some key people in state and federal health agencies know that they're lying to us, that at least some key people in the pharmaceutical industry are profiting knowingly by unnecessary injury and death caused by vaccines and from treating all of the chronic diseases that vaccines create. And this has to do with what's called our psychological worldview. Everybody has a psychological worldview. Many people's psychological worldview does not include these possibilities. Nobody would really do that. Oh, come on, they couldn't really do that. You know, that sort of thing.
They can only wrap their head around greed. People can wrap their head around greed, and they can wrap their head around poisonous foods, you know? So if it's not about poisonous foods or something that is stemming solely from greed, and this is not, as we know, stemming solely from greed, the fact that there are parts within the vaccines that cause sterility, that's not a greed issue.
Yeah, you know, Merck recently, I saw an article, said they lowered the cost of their HPV vaccine by 95% so that they could vaccinate the third world. Now, I don't believe for a second that this was an act of compassion for helping the third world, because this is the same industry that routinely incurs criminal fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and on two occasions there were even billion-dollar criminal fines for Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline, respectively, in 2009 and 2012, mostly for illegal marketing. In other words, these people want to profit so badly that they will engage routinely in criminal behavior and get caught for it a lot of the time. There's apparently a net profit for doing it because they keep doing that same behavior. And they're going to turn around and lower the cost of their product by 95% as a generous gesture to save the third world. No. Sally, there's a fascinating woman by the name of Sherry Edwards who has done some really incredible research over the last two or three decades having to do with what she calls bioacoustics. And in a nutshell, she has developed software programs where she can take a sample of somebody's voice, 30-second sample, say, of someone talking, analyze the frequencies, and tell you detailed information about your physical, physiological, and emotional state at the time of the sample. It's fascinating. I've seen this demonstrated on myself, and it was scary, and I mean that in a good way here, scary how detailed and accurate it was. She has used this to, and it's been, she's done research with the military, with at least one major reputable university. Her system has been validated. She looked at girls who had gotten the HPV vaccine, and the bioacoustic analysis shows reproductive harm. I think it's pretty clear that if you want to vaccinate the third world with the HPV vaccine, it's not about protecting them from cervical cancer. It's about impacting fertility.
You know what, Alan? I have about 14 other questions for you. I only have time for one, and you won't have the time to give me a long answer either. But of what you do know about Obamacare, how will it affect our choices when it comes to vaccines?
Yeah, I have just a few preliminary insights into Obamacare as it pertains to vaccines, but that includes language that has created grants for states. You know, the federal government often doesn't have authority directly to control state action or the activity of state residents. So what they'll do is say, well, okay, states, if you want these federal dollars, you have to do what we say. And that's how they effectively control the states and state residents, even when they don't have direct control.
I don't know if you have seen this, but principals in schools, because it's the same thing, you don't get federal funding unless 98% or whatever percentage of your children are inoculated in your school. I hear now that principals are personally liable, if they don't meet the quota. What do you think of that?
I don't see how you know, a principal could actually be liable. I'm certainly willing to be wrong on that, but I'm skeptical of them actually being liable. That wouldn't make sense. But they could certainly be held accountable.
Okay, but what do you think about parents being held liable for their children's not inoculating their children by
So-called bioethicist Art Kaplan makes that case, and it's totally frivolous and ridiculous. I mean, vaccines cause injury and death, and nobody can tell you what your child's risk is and how bad the injury is going to be and whether it's going to show up right away or, you know, 3 decades down the road. And that fact alone is enough to justify parents in any situation having the right to refuse a vaccine, even if there's a declared emergency or whatever. If they don't want the vaccine, they should be able to say no thank you for themselves and their children. And I could rattle off, I know we don't have time for it, we could have a whole discussion, you know, on a show about that issue.
Yes, and please tell people how they can reach you and what services you offer.
Sure, and thank you so much for allowing me that opportunity. Vaccinerights.com. All my contact information is there. A lot of free information on that site about your rights with vaccine exemptions and waivers, information about the work I've done with legislative activism. There's also an ebook, the only document anywhere that I know of that has authoritative information about your vaccine exemption and waiver law rights. And I work with clients and attorneys around the country in all different kinds of vaccine exemption situations, school, college, military, immigration.
I appreciate your coming on, Alan Phillips of VaccineRights.com. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If we're still on the air, this is Sally L. Cordy, Ban Vaccines, visit BillionToddlerMarchForSurvival.blogspot.com. I thought we were off the air. Sorry, Alan Phillips, for cutting you off. Cheerio for now.